a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of ImaginePublicity.com, welcoming you this evening and every Saturday evening for our issues-driven radio show in order to educate you about topics that you may not know about, may be of interest, and things that you that may not have occurred on your radar. And I think tonight is one of those times. And I'm very pleased to have two guests along with my co-host on a very unique topic. So before we begin the discussion, I want to say good evening, Delilah. Such a pleasure to have you. How's everything in South Carolina?
Hi, Donna. Everything's fine. Kind of a gloomy, rainy day today, but it was a good day to have one. And I agree with you. This is a very, very unique topic. We've done, you know, a lot of shows in the past couple of years about how a particular tragedy or crime or has created victims and how they pick up their lives afterwards or if they do. Then we've also done a lot of shows on health and wellness, too. So this is kind of combining the two, and I think that there's so much information to be learned about the tragedies that our guests have suffered through and also the causes of these tragedies.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm very glad. And I'm also very glad because I happen to have I've known about this topic for a couple of years, and it's taken our guest with myself and a lot of kind of push and pull to try to get it together. Michael Smith of San Diego, whose brother Patrick was tragically killed in Connecticut, and we also have another guest from Idaho, although her daughter was killed in Montana. And if we're lucky, we may have a Dr. Stephen Eidelman. We tried very diligently to get in touch with him and his PR manager this week, and hopefully he may come on to address the diabetic aspect, but we weren't able to get in direct contact, so we're not sure. We're just waiting to see if he comes on fine. If not, oh well. And but I know that Mike is well-versed in some of these issues, and I think Pat Tucker also can speak to some of these things. So our topic formally is homicide as a result of diabetic shock, diabetic mismanagement, causing someone behind the wheel to go unconscious and cause injuries, cause fatalities. And you say, did this really happen? Well, in the course of knowing Michael and in talking to other people and doing research, this happens far too often, and I don't think it's taken seriously enough. So I'm so very glad to have this topic. So why don't we start out, I know that Pat is holding on the line. Why don't we start out with Mike? And I have to say, Mike, thank you so much for being on Shattered Lives. It's a pleasure to have you.
Likewise, Donna, thank you for allowing me to talk about my brother and this issue.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So why don't we start out by talking about what your brother was like a little bit on a personal level, and then maybe what were the circumstances that occurred, and let's tie in the whole issue of diabetes, because I really think that our audience needs to be educated about that in particular, okay?
Okay, Donna. Just an overview of my brother. He was 39, a single parent, divorced, just going about his daily life. He was actually on his way to work at 6 a.m. the morning of the accident and was at an intersection in Mansfield, Connecticut at a stoplight, waiting for the light to turn green. When his light turned green, he went through the intersection, and coming from the opposite direction, this gentleman that was driving, he was already in diabetic shock. And when this happens, people actually go into almost like a trance, where mm-hmm. they're not really aware of their surroundings and what they're doing. It's almost like they're in a tunnel. And they're just frozen, zombie-like almost. And this man didn't pay heed to the stoplight and crashed his pickup truck into my brother's little Saturn, T-boning the car. And my brother suffered, you know, immediate life-threatening injuries. And his car was pushed up against the side of the road. According to some witnesses that came out from the Durham Bus Company, which was right next to where his car stopped, and I forget if it was a 7-Eleven or some gas station across the street, you know, some people who saw the crash happen ran up to see if they could help, but unfortunately he was, you know, in the last minute or two of his conscious life. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately he died on the scene. But just to give you an idea of how this man was in a trance, even after the collision, and I think police stated this truck was traveling at 50 or 60 miles an hour, but it struck my brother's car. He still was in this trance. He put his truck into reverse after he kind of, you know, shook off. He must have hit his head on the steering wheel. He put mm-hmm. the truck in reverse, and then he went driving away with, you know, witnesses chasing him, screaming, stop, stop. And he went a quarter of a mile further up Route 190, and he caused another accident. But
so he had two consecutive accidents in the the time span of what, a couple of minutes?
Yes, correct.
While he was in this state of, like, subconsciousness, is that what you're saying?
Yes. He was in hypoglycemic shock, meaning low blood sugar. I believe in the paperwork I read, his blood sugar level was 24 when the EMT checked it, and normal is close to 100 or over.
Right.
So he was, right, zombie-like state.
That is incredible. What was his history and background with regard to medical history, or just, you know, did he have a criminal record prior to this? What do you know?
From the documents I was able to obtain, and of course, a lot of medical things are personal, so not just everyone can have access to them. But I was allowed some information through the accident report, which I have in front of me. Mm-hmm. He had been diagnosed with diabetes 15 years before this crash, and my brother's accident happened in 2007. And apparently the man told hospital personnel at Rockville General Hospital that, I think because he had just become comfortable or accustomed to having diabetes, he told hospital personnel that he never checked his glucose levels, and he just injected, you know, some predetermined amount.
When he felt like it?
But whatever he felt like. Apparently he had been doing this for some time, and whatever that amount was, he just did regularly without checking glucose sugar levels. I don't know if you or maybe people in the audience understand. People take glucose to kind of counter-affect sugar intake. So when they eat something, mm-hmm. the insulin is supposed to keep the blood sugar from skyrocketing.
Right.
That way, the insulin kind of keeps an equilibrium so you don't have erratic highs and lows. So it's imperative for you to know where your glucose levels are so you can take an appropriate amount of insulin. Otherwise, it's guesswork. And
right.
Unfortunately, that's pretty pretty much what led to this accident.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're calling in, and this was negligence. It was noncompliance. It was he intentionally did not comply. What kind of definition did the state of Connecticut use with regard to this? How did they term this?
The letter we got from Tallinn County District Attorney Matthew Dansky, and our family had requested to speak with him several times, and we were never able to sit face-to-face across from mm-hmm. him and discuss this. He essentially summed up this crash as an unfortunate accident, despite my asking, how can this not be negligence? This man mismanaged a medical issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's commonplace for doctors to educate patients with diabetes how to maintain a healthy lifestyle, how to counter high and or low blood sugar with your insulin, how to keep everything in check so you are not a danger to yourself or those around you. And mm-hmm. it's common knowledge that physicians will try and educate patients to, you know, check your blood sugar level at appropriate times, perhaps before
right.
you get behind the wheel of the car to go for a drive, before and after you eat. It's just part of what is necessary
right.
to keep your health in check. And unfortunately,
Did he have other kind of charges that you could get access to, or that the police were able to divulge? You weren't able to obtain that
information. So, unfortunately, no. The only reason I am aware of statements that were made to attending physicians at Rockville General Hospital, that's where this man was taken after the crash.
Right.
Kind of came to me by accident. So that's partly why I'm not using a name.
Right.
The name of the driver.
Right. Well, that's fine. Let me ask
a quick question, Doc.
Go ahead.
And this particular gentleman, you know, it's very human nature that we have to find out the who, what, when, where, and why of something when it happens like this. And we need to question, just like you have. And I think one of my questions would be, obviously from what you're saying, this gentleman was not managing his disease properly. Now, where do we place the accountability for that? Do we place that on him personally? Do we place it on his doctor? Do we know what kind of instruction and what kind of education he gave this patient about his disease and how to manage it properly? From what you've said, he was just, you know, shooting up the insulin and not really checking his glucose levels, and I find
right.
that to be kind of alarming for anyone with, you know, with a chronic illness like diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure his physician probably gave him some tools to work with, some information, but in the end,
it's part
it
of the protocol.
Down.
Yeah,
it, exactly.
It's part of the
protocol. I even went so far as to get a package of the type of insulin that this man used. And on the side of, I'm trying to remember the name of the medicine off the top of my head, but there's distinct instructions down the side. Danger, check glucose levels appropriately before
mm-hmm.
eating, after eating, before bathing, behind the wheel of a motor vehicle. This shouldn't have been a mystery to the man, I'm sure, besides his doctor and besides whatever place he went to get his prescription, I'm sure gave him an education, and it is on the box on the side of the medicine that the pharmaceutical
right.
producer.
Well, you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to say, because I worked in medical settings for many years, too, as a speech-language pathologist, that if this person was that noncompliant and indifferent to his health with regard to that, I'm going to say that it probably spilled over into other areas of his life, and this wasn't the only thing that he probably didn't do that he should have done with respect to, you know, keeping
probably
up with the things that he should, you know. But we just don't know. Can you give us a summary, and then I want to bring Pat in, because she has a very interesting story as well. But give us a summary, Mike, with regard to what you have done in the last few years with regard to trying to get awareness. And I know that it really hasn't risen to the level of a criminal trial because of what the DA has said. So what other measures have you tried, and what would you like to do? And then we'll bring Pat in.
I have managed to get, I think it was 6 or 7 articles published in newspapers in the state of Connecticut. David Owens at the Hartford Current covered an article for me.
Doesn't matter what their names were.
There was a newspaper, the Journal Enquirer in Manchester, I think wrote 2 or 3 articles. And Zachary Janowski, who at the time was a writer at the Willimantic Chronicle, he took a great interest in writing articles for me. I also wanted to mention, there used to be a great reporter at Channel 3 in Hartford, Connecticut, named Alicia Cheney. She was the initial news reporter that covered the accident that morning in Mansfield. And she later telephoned me and interviewed myself and my mother and my father, Robert Smith and Jean Smith. And she did a very nice job of presenting the view from the family. Over the past few years, of course, I was very angry about this for a long time, and I, looking back, understand that maybe my anger and my attention to getting people to listen to me probably pushed people away, because I can be a very forward person. Over the last 2 or 3 years, probably about the time I started communicating with Donna a couple of years ago, I suddenly realized that at this point, the most important thing I can do is bring awareness to the situation to, in a way, honor my brother so he is not forgotten. But at this point, I'm interested in saving other people's lives to keep things like this from happening again, whether it's the life of someone who's not managing their diabetes correctly or someone who is, who just is having an off day, but also the lives of innocent people around impaired diabetics, because they're out on the street. You could have passed one on your way to work yesterday. It's a little frightening to think that this could happen to anybody, anywhere. So if any life can be saved by a little awareness, I'm all for it.
Well, that's great. And one thing, is this the type of situation where you think hiring of a private investigator would have helped at a particular point?
Perhaps. I hired an investigator from Connecticut Investigative Services, I think his name was Tom. He was trying to obtain, you know, information for me so I could piece together things. In some circumstances, yes. I still am a little concerned. There were actually 2 other accidents that happened in Connecticut involving impaired diabetics that just so happened to have involved Connecticut police officers. One, unfortunately, Officer Adolfo was killed Thanksgiving weekend 1989 in Greenwich.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to contact his widow to see if she could participate today, but the phone number I have is at her current mm-hmm. one, so I couldn't get through to her. And another happened in 2002 in Enfield, Connecticut. Oddly enough, my mother works for a physician in Enfield and in Stafford Springs, Connecticut. And this Enfield police officer happens to be one of my mother's patients.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is William Ludeman.
Mm-hmm.
He was struck by an impaired diabetic. It was a woman. She was a librarian in East Hartford, Connecticut. He suffered some fairly major injuries, but thankfully he survived.
And have those cases been gotten any press?
A little bit, a smattering. But the state of Connecticut had charged the drivers in both cases. And it always had bothered me that the response I got from the state of Connecticut, from the district attorney of Collin County, he chose to look at this accident just as that, a sad accident.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I've always thought there's been a little bit more to it because of the negligence in taking care of your medical situation before you get behind the wheel of a car. So that's been a hot spot for me for a while.
Definitely.
Long time.
I totally agree. And just so can you tell us what consequences there was for this perpetrator? And then I really do want to ask Pat if she could weigh in here so we could all share in the conversation. What consequences were there for this particular person who I might mention offhand, although it has no direct bearing, I don't think. He is, I believe, a relative of one of our state legislators. So who knows if there was some kind of political, well, let's kind of bury this. I'm just putting that out there as a possibility. But in any case, did he have any consequences?
No. And to date, the man that struck my brother's car has yet to receive even a traffic ticket for running that red light that morning. Essentially nothing happened to him.
Wow.
I petitioned
incredible.
The state of Connecticut Motor Vehicle Department to suspend his license, which I was successful mm-hmm. in getting done.
Yes.
So about 6 months later, apparently in Connecticut, if you have a license suspended for a medical reason, you can have it reinstated by having your doctor fill out some forms and saying that, okay, we feel that you have overcome whatever medical issue you have control of now, you're
wow.
able to drive. And that has irritated me because wouldn't you think your own private doctor might have a personal interest?
What I'm wondering is if a doctor signs off on this, and maybe Pat can address this too in her state, if a doctor does sign off on this after, okay, it's 2014 and this happened 7 years ago, and the doctor says, okay, I think this person has sufficiently stabilized, that they have to sign an affidavit to say, I will promise that I have to maintain my diabetes management and I will be monitored by my doctor, you know, once a month or something. Is there any caveat to that?
I wish it worked that way,
But it
might put the doctor in a position of taking responsibility for making that statement.
Yeah. Well, I think
typically,
it's a good idea.
Typically it's the Department of Motor Vehicles, the DMVs, that in some states require affidavits from people with medical conditions saying that they have not had an episode. Typically, it's within the past year. And they sign off on that, and sometimes obviously they're being truthful and sometimes they're not. And
right.
as far as I've done research on that because of trying to beef those affidavits up, and
yep.
the strictest that I found is typically just that. They swear in writing that they haven't had an episode for 1 year.
But is there any mandate to have the doctor also witness that affidavit?
In some states, very few, the doctor is required to sign off. If there has been an episode and the person's license is suspended, then the doctor definitely has to agree to the person's license being reinstated.
Right. But it sounds like in my state, in the state of Connecticut, they're not among those that you're just speaking of, which is very disturbing to me. Wow. Pat, just let me say thank you so much for coming on the show. We're very, very glad to have you. Can you tell us what happened to your daughter?
Yes. And first, thank you so much for having me on the show. And, Michael, this is the first time I've heard the entire story about your brother, Patrick, and it's heartbreaking. My daughter was 11 years of age, and she was a very bright girl, Katie Tucker, C-A-D-Y, and I say her name and spell it because very special, and I worked really hard to come up with a unique spelling of Katie. And so I just put everything into my daughter I possibly could. She was a great runner, a classical guitarist. She was the best reader in her school. She was a beautiful artist. And 2 weeks before sixth grade, she wanted to go with her cousin on a trip just before school. And so she was in the car in Montana. She had been swimming at a place called Holland Lake, Montana, with a cousin and a very long-term family friend. And they were driving back to Missoula, Montana. And they were just 4 miles away from where they had been swimming, and they were headed south. And the northbound car was driven by a woman who had had a very, very long history of noncompliance with diabetes. About a month before the crash occurred, she had a blood sugar of 600. Unlike the person who caused Patrick's death, this woman had experienced this hyperglycemia, extremely high blood sugar and noncompliance. And a few days before the episode, she had explained that she was on vacation from taking care of her diabetes. She had seen a specialist.
Wait a minute. On vacation from taking care of your diabetes?
Yes,
is that
correct.
What she said?
That's what she told her doctor. That is correct.
I've never heard that term. Have you, Delilah?
No,
and,
I can't say that I have.
So she had seen a specialist a week before, and he had said, your diabetes is in terrible control and needs to improve rapidly. She was put on different medication. For 3 days before she drove, when the crash occurred, she had not tested her blood sugar for 3 days with that admonishment from her specialist, from a diabetologist.
Uh-huh.
And so it was about 3:56 in the afternoon, and as I said, Katie was in one car. The oncoming car was driven by the noncompliant diabetic with uncontrolled blood sugar, and the driver, the diabetic driver, drove 10 feet over the center line of this narrow two-lane highway all the way over to the other side, and God knows why, she said, oh, my God, because this was in the affidavit that I got of a brief interview of her after the crash that was done by the Montana Highway Patrol, and she turned back into traffic, and that is statistically what people do who have lost consciousness. Maybe it's the gravel under the tires or whatever it is, and she had turned directly back into traffic, and that was the fatal instinctive reaction that caused my daughter's death, because then she turned right into the passenger side, causing an off-center, the most dangerous head-on collision.
And there were three vehicles involved in this crash, correct, from what I read in the report?
That is correct. There was a car following the car Katie was in, and that car collided with the Taurus that the diabetic driver was driving. And so my daughter's car was catapulted 180 degrees to land on the opposite side of the highway facing the opposite direction, so that when the Montana Highway Patrol first arrived on the scene, they thought my daughter's car was northbound instead of southbound. And Katie was partially ejected from the car. She was in a seatbelt. This was August 15th of 2002. The car she was in did not have an airbag. The car that the diabetic driver was driving did, and Katie was pronounced dead at the scene at 6 o'clock that evening by the county coroner. She slammed into the door pillar of the car, which caused an indentation of her forehead, and she unfortunately did not receive any emergency help, and that was because of massive confusion, and she died at the scene. And we
do you mean they didn't call EMTs to the scene, Pat?
EMTs were called, Donna. However, what happened, the car behind the third car in the collision pulled over and waited for whatever reason for 10 minutes, I was told, before they got out to help. And finally, the screaming of my nephew, Katie's cousin, who was in the back seat behind Katie, caused them to say that they couldn't stand the screaming anymore. So they got out, and one of them had expired CPR qualifications, and she felt for Katie's pulse. And when the EMT assigned to Katie arrived, this person said, "She's already gone." So the EMT turned around and walked away. And, of course, that's not following protocol in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry.
And so Katie was allowed to simply just wither away at the scene. And we had a pathologist look at the photographs that were taken and so on afterward. And the pathologist said that her heart had been beating for some time afterward because of the extreme bruising and so on. But in any event, getting back to the situation, there was discussion about how we take care of our illnesses reflects other aspects of our lives. That is absolutely true. There's a brilliant book called Traffic Safety by Leonard Evans, which talks about a study that was done in Canada that has the quote, and the title of the study is, "We Drive as We Live." Mm-hmm. And then there's another quote that is, "How we do anything is how we do everything." And I find that absolutely to be true. If we are reckless in our personal care, we're going to be reckless on the highway. And the critical issue among many of the critical issues here is accountability and trying to deter future deaths, as Michael talked about. And if we don't hold people accountable, then we're not going to see the improvements that we should from each of the fatalities that does occur. And you have to remember that the number one cause of death of people 2 years of age to 35 years of age in this country is traffic fatalities, the number one cause. And we are not holding people accountable the way that we should. There were never any charges pressed against the person who caused my daughter's death, though the Highway Patrol told me that it was a horrific crash, three-car crash, and that she would be charged with a fatality. We had.
And now, how is that possible? Tell us. I know that we talked off air, but how is that possible? Listening to this, the carnage and the horror story. What? How can that be?
I think that's an excellent question, and I've asked myself that question countless times, and I have come up with the conclusion that the prosecutors in counties or in district areas vary so greatly from area from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, And it's very, very difficult, and a lot of it, unfortunately, is based on luck. Are you lucky enough to find someone who may help you? If you're helpless on the side of the road, are you lucky enough to get a good prosecutor who's going to be ethical and do what he or she should? And in our case, we had a prosecutor who was not interested, as far as I can tell, in prosecuting. You have to keep in mind that this was not a case of drunk driving. We have a culture of prosecuting drunk drivers. We have not gotten to a culture yet of prosecuting people with recklessness in treating medical conditions. And right. I have interviewed many, many people, one of them being a police sergeant in Idaho Falls, where I live currently. And he produced a video of a diabetic driver he saw driving, and it was unbelievable. He showed it to me at an event I hosted, and the person was going in and out of traffic, one side of the road to the other side of the road, and it was unbelievable. And his comment was that diabetic drivers, when they are in their state of unconsciousness, are worse than drunk drivers, and he said there's simply nothing going on. There's nothing going on neurologically.
I don't know. I'm almost speechless. That's almost impossible for me.
Also keep in mind, Donna, and Mike and Delilah and the audience, that there is a condition called hypoglycemic unawareness, and that occurs with long-term diabetics. That means that they have such nerve damage that they get to a point of going into a diabetic shock condition with no warning whatsoever. And that is why it's imperative that they check their blood sugar. The American Diabetes Association recommendation is that every insulin diabetic driver check his or her blood sugar before getting behind the wheel and every 2 hours thereafter.
Well, that was going to be a question is you know, these patients, how do they have warning when this is happening? What kind of warning? And do they have time to pull off the road to do something besides, you know, go down the street in a trance?
Well, some of them do, and some of them are beyond that and have this hypoglycemic unawareness, and that's why testing the blood sugar is so completely critical. Others who are not that far advanced have tingling, have a sense of drowsiness, and I think we all have a sense of the symptoms that come from drowsy driving, and
right.
some of those are similar.
I was wondering about the aspect of, this reminded me of a previous conversation with regard to any potential prosecutions. Is it, Mike, did you get the sense in Connecticut, and I remember Delilah and I talking about this, if the VAs feel it's not a winnable case, because that's important to them, then they won't pursue. Is that the sense you got, Mike?
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah.
The two accidents I was talking about in Connecticut that happened to police officers, it just has troubled me that attention was paid to that because they were state employees. My brother was a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of similar circumstances with all of the drivers involved. They were all in hypoglycemic shock. It
right.
just bothered me that my brother's situation didn't warrant interest from the state of Connecticut. And that has been very frustrating for myself and my family.
I'm sure it is, and that's why we're trying to do our part now. But Pat or Mike, what is the incidence in terms of the number of incidents that you know of or has been compiled of the fatalities with the diabetic shock or the hypoglycemic shock? Do you have a number?
In the state of Idaho?
Well, in the state of Idaho and across the nation.
I have tried to find that out. You have to remember that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration
right.
does not require that information, and so it's very, very difficult to obtain. I simply don't know that. I have touched base with a number of people trying to obtain that information. There is a renowned physician in Idaho Falls named Dr. John Lilienquist, who has testified with me and provided support for my case in the past, and he has talked about how many, many of his patients have talked about causing collisions because they have not taken care of their medication properly, and he feels that we really have to take control of this issue. And let me just give you some statistics. In 1958, we had 1.5 million diabetics. Currently, we have 20 million. By 2050, a third of the population will be diabetic if present trends continue. We have to take control of this issue for the safety of everybody on the highway.
Especially with obesity and with children being obese and going, skipping the, going into type 2 diabetes when they're, a preteen and all of that. That's very, very scary. I know. I'm wondering whether Mike, do you know, has the American Diabetes Association taken any stance on this at all?
No, outside of their recommendations and how to manage, I am not aware that they have supported any victim or made any statement. Nothing that I'm aware of, unfortunately.
That's very unfortunate because they would be, a very good spokesperson for, trying to eliminate that kind of thing. Mike, can you speak to, since it's very apparent now that Dr. Edelman is, I'm sure, not going to be joining us because we have about 17 minutes left to the show, just to kind of give each of you a benchmark. But can you speak to what a medical expert would do with regard to this kind of case? I know he was going to be speaking about the two college students, Mary Bernstein and Robert Conway, who died in San Jose. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I have a general knowledge of that.
Okay.
The two college students, Mary Bernstein and her fiance, Robert Conway, were actually sitting at a traffic intersection when they were rear-ended by a Pacific Gas and Electric utility truck driven by John Mayfield.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what led up to this happening was, and incidentally, their pickup truck burst into flames, and they died a horrific death. Mr. Mayfield, who was an employee of Pacific Gas and Electric, had been, I think, 5 to 10 minutes previous, sitting in the parking lot of a Walmart or a Walgreens or something where he got his prescription. He went to inject himself with insulin through a needle, and something happened with the injector, so he wasn't sure if he got the dosage. So instead of waiting a few minutes and checking his blood sugar levels to see if there was a change, which would tell him if he injected himself with the insulin, he got another cartridge and he injected himself again, effectively double dosing. Right,
dose,
since he wasn't sure if the first injection took, it did. His blood sugar level plummeted. He was attempting to drive. I can't remember where he was headed. But anyway, he got on the main street.
He was attempting to drive to a convenience store to get a carbohydrate.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's what it was.
Okay. What happened after that?
He crashed into Ms. Bernstein's truck, and it burst into flames, and she and her fiance were killed at the scene. I've been in contact, not recently, but over the past few years, with the mother Lisa Bernstein, who I had hoped would be participating with us today. I don't know if maybe mentally she's in a different place and she's not able to do this. I don't know what the reason is, but she's not she's not with us today to speak, and that's kind of unfortunate.
But she was able to accomplish some, pass some new laws with respect to what happened regarding Mary, correct?
Yes. Pacific Gas and Electric at the time was able to self-insure employees. I'm sure it was done as a cost-saving effect instead of outsourcing insurance. They would just buy bulk insurance for their own employees, and this way, if there were medical issues or incidents or whatever, that didn't affect the cost of the insurance. Since the accident, the mother, Lisa Bernstein, made some changes in the way large companies have to provide insurance coverage for their vehicles that are out on the road. And these companies like Pacific Gas and Electric are no longer allowed to self-insure, which I think is a great idea because there's more than the self-interest of the company and saving money on insurance.
Right. Well, wasn't it also that she got the she got a mandate such that these people that drive or have commercial licenses they must monitor any kind of medical or medical management if they're going to be a commercial truck driver? Is that right? Is that right, Pat?
Correct. That's correct.
Yeah.
And I'm also pleased to say that she has a number of signs around the Sacramento, California area that they're issued by the Department of Motor Vehicles here in California that say drive impaired, not just alcohol-related, but medically impaired. And then there's a memorial at the bottom to her daughter, which nice. She was able to accomplish some things, and I'm very proud of her.
Well, that's great. I think that's wonderful. Pat, can you tell us about the efforts that have been underway with regard to what you've gotten accomplished in Idaho?
I would love to. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about that. Not only in Idaho, the first state where we had some progress was in Montana. One of the excuses that we got for not prosecuting was that the statute of limitations had expired for a misdemeanor charge, and the prosecutors told us that they felt that a negligent homicide charge was too severe, even though in my family's opinion it was exactly the right charge.
You have to be kidding.
Yes, and so they had said because the misdemeanor statute of limitations had expired, there was nothing that they could do. So in 2009, we were successful in Montana in getting the statute of limitations for a misdemeanor charge resulting in a fatality extended from 1 year to 3 years. And this is particularly important in medical cases where medical records have to be obtained. The evidence is not quite as cut and dried as it is in some other cases, and I was really pleased about being able to do that. In Idaho, I've tried to go before the legislature many times over, and I think because of the prevalence of the problem of diabetes, there is a lot of resistance in getting change, and I wish that the American Diabetes Association would come on board because it would save many lives. The recommendation of the American Diabetes Association is that there be a carb in the car. That would have potentially saved Patrick's life. It would have potentially saved Mary and Robert's lives, and it would have potentially saved my daughter's life. In Idaho, I have this year gotten successful with getting a bill before the House Judiciary Committee, and that bill had language that if a medical condition is not being treated and the failure to treat is a cause of being unable to drive safely, then that person should be held accountable for inattentive driving. And I was successful by a vote of 13 to 15 in the House committee, and then it failed on the floor. And the debate involved discussion about, oh, well, you know, my daughter's a diabetic and I don't want her to come under this law, and so on and so forth. And so
right.
I worked with a number of legislators after the session closed, and we discussed changing the language, and we're going before the legislature again in 2015. And I hope, Michael, that you can be involved as well with providing testimony. And this will say simply that if you operate a vehicle with and you know, or you should know, that you are not capable of operating the vehicle in a safe manner, then again, you should be held accountable for inattentive driving. And it's not closely what I would like, but it is a step in the right direction in terms of creating this awareness of needing to be alert when we're driving so that we're capable of driving safely, and that's what it's all about.
That's great. Well, what do you
and
think,
I did
Jeff?
Want to say that we tried all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to get prosecution for accountability, and we just failed at every count, primarily because of prosecutorial discretion, and it is so important for prosecutors to be willing to do the right thing for public safety.
I couldn't agree more. I can't understand. What do each of you think would be a just sentence or punishment in these cases? Or do you think, oh, it has to, you know, be individually determined as, you know, whether it be a fatality or an injury? Would you say a mandatory sentence of X number of years and community service? Or what would you envision would be appropriate, Mike? And then we'll ask Pat, too.
Looking at Pat's case about her daughter, Katie, since there was blatant mismanagement for years, I would say 10 to 20 years in prison, period. I'm repulsed every time I hear that story.
How about in the case of your brother?
In the case of my brother, I know there was some mismanagement. I don't have any specifics, again, because it's, you know, a lot of medical information is personal. So I don't know specifically if this man suffered other incidents, if there's, you know, a track record of this.
Right.
But seeing his willful mismanagement of his health, his disinterest in checking his blood sugar levels before getting the – if I was a prosecutor, I would throw 5 years at that man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in terms of group efforts, Pat, what do you think needs to be done, as a coalition, as a group nationwide to increase awareness? And, I mean, besides the legislative aspect on each individual state's basis, what else needs to be done?
Well, I wanted to go back and address the issue about the length of time of a prison sentence or whatever the punishment should be. My feeling, and maybe Mike disagrees with me, but what I really wanted as Katie's mother was to meet with the family to understand what exactly happened. Because she was never charged, she wasn't questioned thoroughly. The information is just out there as a complete unknown. And I wanted a sense of restorative justice, which is meeting with the family, having the opportunity to hear an apology. Other victims, the families of other victims I've spoken with and read about have said that apology is very, very important. And to simply know the truth of what was going on, of what caused it, so then there can be some sense of building better legislation and improving public safety based on the facts. And if you don't ever get to the facts, you never get to improving public safety. In terms of what should be done as a country, I think we need a national law concerning safe driving. We need a national campaign. Each state doing something quite different just isn't working. You know, we have states like Massachusetts that have superb laws. We have states, rural states like Idaho and Montana that are very lax. And it's simply not right. We need a national campaign. We need national legislation. And
I think you have very, very good suggestions. Go ahead, Mike. What?
No, I agree. I wanted to mention that certain countries, Canada is one, and Germany another, both take driving very, very seriously. To get a driver's license and to maintain a driver's license is a very expensive proposition. There have been situations where an incident like what happened to Katie or to my brother, should something like that happen, and I've learned a lot just from Googling, you know, to find accidents.
Right.
This is how I found Pat. I did a Google search for diabetes accident. That's how Pat and I got connected.
So other countries deal with it very, very differently, right?
Exactly. Your license is taken away, and there was a thorough investigation. And if there is a problem in managing your medical situation, you do not get your driver's license back.
If there's no crying,
I can't get to work, you do not drive.
Excellent
point, Mike. And the country of Sweden has a national campaign called Vision Zero, and their approach is that one death caused by a traffic fatality is too many.
It's too many, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So these are very proactive countries. You know, in our last 2 minutes, I was wondering, how are each of you doing in terms of your nuclear or extended family and dealing with this tragedy? I wonder if you could just talk about that very briefly before we go, and then I want to give contact information.
Why don't you go ahead first, Pat?
It's been very, very difficult, even to this day. I don't think anyone else can really understand how comprehensive the fallout is from a fatality. It just affects every aspect of one's life. And as Mike talked about, I have come to the conclusion as well that what I can do is try to prevent future fatalities, but it's very frustrating because change in this country and the mindset in this country is not conducive to being able to take action within a reasonable time period. It's very slow, and we do need to follow the lead of other countries. We do not have a good fatality rate in this country. It is low. The last time I checked, it was the 29th in the world, as opposed to 1, 2, or 3 where it should be. We have a powerful car and oil corporations that
control things.
Exactly,
yeah.
That really don't want to focus on public safety as much as profit.
I understand. Now, Mike, how's everybody in your?
It changed the entire family dynamic. My parents had 2 children, my brother and I.
Yeah.
It changed everything. It's just very sad.
I'm sure, but, you know, I commend both of you for what you're doing, and we're trying to do our part. Can you both briefly give contact information before we have to sign off, if anyone wants to get in touch?
My brother has a Yahoo group page, Justice for Bat, at yahoogroup.com. Please email me.
All right. And Pat?
I would like to be contacted by email or by my phone number. Either would be great for me. My email is ccrtucker@gmail.com, and my phone number is 208 569-4157. Thank you
so much.
Well,
that's great. Well, you're
thank
welcome.
Thank you, everybody.
And I thank you. Delilah, any parting comment?
I just really commend both of you for looking for solutions. I think a lot of times people in your circumstances just don't know what to do. And you've both found a way and found a path that will definitely help other people, hopefully prevent them from having the same tragedies. But, the solutions are hard to work for, and I salute you both.
Thank you, Delilah. Thank you, Donna. And thank you, Pat.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And everyone, please stay tuned and tune in next Saturday for the next episode, and stay tuned for our Showcase Blog and Podcast maybe sometime tomorrow. Okay, so we'll be signing off this evening, and have a good week, everyone. Good night.